This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Carol Tilley. She's an associate professor at the Graduate School of Library and Information Science at the University of Illinois. Part of her scholarship focuses on the intersection of young people, comics, and libraries. You can find her online at caroltilley.net. Carol, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Steve. It's great to talk to you and get to be part of your project.
We're going to talk probably a lot about comics today, but I wanted to start off with something else that you're actually the third person to be on the show who's been on a game show. You're the second Jeopardy person, and I had somebody else who was on Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Okay.
What was that like being on Jeopardy? It seems like a kind of librarian dream kind of job, a dream show.
You know, it really was kind of very dreamlike. I have entered the screening test just kind of on a lark. I never watched Jeopardy all that much, but I've always been a trivia buff, and I was amazed that I passed through the first round of the screening and the second round of the screening, and I waited nearly 8 months before I got the call to come out to California for the taping. And it was a great couple of days. So even though I didn't win, I made a friend from one of the other contestants. And I had a lot of fun seeing how a show like that gets put together.
It's great. Was that Alex with the mustache or without the mustache?
Oh gosh, I think without. It's been long enough. I have my framed photo of Alex and me at home, so I could tell you later.
Well, I think you're you're mostly known in the library world because you're the subject of most of your scholarship has been comics.
Yes.
What drew you to comics initially? Not necessarily as a research thing, but what drew you to them as either a kid or whenever you first got involved with them?
You know, I tell this story a lot, and it sounds a little bit idyllic, and maybe it is, but I grew up in a little town in southern Indiana on the same block as the public library, and I went to the public library obsessively. I mean, even at age 3, I was there pretty much every day of the week. But even as a young kid, I loved comics. My dad, both my parents actually were children of the Depression era. And my dad had grown up with newspaper comics. And so we were always sort of sparring with each other over the funny pages in the paper every day. But beyond that, I discovered really early that the drugstore down the block also had a comics rack. And I would go there on Saturday mornings and sit on the floor and read comics. I loved the ridiculous stories. I mean, this was mostly Archie and Richie Rich and Hot Stuff and really kind of innocuous comics. But I would sit and read the comics, and then I would usually buy one and take home with me. And when I went to library school in the early 90s, I really began thinking about how I had been such an avid library user throughout my childhood and adolescence, but there really weren't any comics in the library. I had to go somewhere else to get those. And when I first went into the job as a high school librarian, I really began to wrestle with the question of why don't we have comics in the library. And sure, there were, you know, Garfield and some Peanuts and some odds and ends like that, but there really seemed to be this great separation between libraries and comics. And I was motivated by that, I think, going back into a doctoral program later. But going back to the question of how I got into comics, I think it was just part of my childhood, part of my sort of everyday family culture. When we would go to bookstores when I was growing up, I would always spend part of my money on the latest Dennis the Menace collection or a family circus collection. I was addicted to Bloom County and the Far Side through high school, like a lot of people my age. So it just always seemed a natural part of print culture more generally in my life.
There's been a lot of progress recently in comics and making them more diverse to women and to other cultures. Did you feel that when you were growing up, that there you felt you wished that there were more women characters, especially being a woman?
Well, you know, that's really strange because I did read some comics that had women and girl characters in them, you know. So, of course, Archie, even though Archie was the titular figure there, I mean, there were, you know, the Betty and Veronica comics. Peanuts had plenty of girls in the lineup. But for me, I grew up, the town I grew up in was very homogenous. It was 99.6% white. And it didn't really begin to dawn on me the value of having ethnically, racially, religiously, culturally diverse characters in comics until much later. And I think that's just a factor of where I grew up and sort of going out into the world and seeing what things, how things were so much different than where I grew up.
Well, let's go back a long way in comics because comics history is something of your specialty. So back in the sort of the post, so Superman was sort of came out in 1938 and was the big boom for comic books, especially. But after that, there were lots of, not diversity in the sense we were just speaking of, but lots of different kinds of comics back then. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know it's kind of come that way again now where we're seeing a lot more diversity. But for a long period, it was sort of, you thought about comics and it's comic books and it's superheroes. But in the 40s and 50s, there was a lot more going on.
Yeah, there really was. I am continually amazed as I go back and read comics from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, just really maybe not ethnic diversity so much or racial diversity, but certainly diversity in storytelling, diversity in visual style. There, from the early days of comic books in the mid-1930s going forward, there was just this phenomenal array of different genres, different visual aesthetics. So you could open up a comic book early on and be confronted with a Western, a mystery, sort of a gag comic, a pirate story, an adventure story, a kids-centered humor comic. And as comics continued to diversify in the 1940s, readers would have found things like romance and horror and jungle comics and crime comics and supernatural stories, really just almost anything you can imagine. There was a comic representation of that. And as I go back and read this stuff, it's just, it fascinates me that so much of this dropped out after the Comics Code was implemented in the mid-1950s. And I really think that we're just now beginning to see, in the last 5 to 10 years, a real push forward in the kinds of diverse storytelling and genre styles that we saw early on in comics.
And the Comics Code you mentioned came about due to some Senate investigations, and one of their star witnesses is someone that you have written about quite a bit, Dr. Wortham. Can you talk a little bit about about him and what his point was? Because I've always thought is there was this, or at least perceived, rise of juvenile delinquency, and so they were looking sort of for a scapegoat, and Dr. Wortham sort of handed comics to them on a platter. But
well, that's pretty much it. But I think that to get a full sense of things, it's important to realize that even when newspaper comics were really first part of U.S. culture, going back to the turn of the 20th century and really the first decade of the 20th century, there were some immediate and incredibly visceral reactions against comics from teachers and religious leaders and mothers groups and cultural critics and librarians too. And they saw these early newspaper comics as being coarse in terms of language and subject matter, that they felt that they were too irreverent, that they would lead kids down the path of disobedience and illiteracy and a whole host of other, bad responses or poor behaviors. And you see, beginning in the around 1940, the same kind of sentiment arising around comics, comic books, which were still a fairly new format at that time. And you see early on some of these same style arguments that comics are going to turn kids into sex-depraved maniacs, that they're going to make kids illiterate, that they are going to be incapable of being successful civic participants in a democracy, that they're going to start injecting all kinds of illicit drugs. You name it, the argument was made about comics in that regard. And so part of that, I think, was just this lasting fear of something new and something child-selected, because these comics were really perhaps the first mass medium that kids could purchase and claim for themselves. And I think that's a really important feature. But there's also this changing relationship to young people, so that because of the Depression, there are more young people who are no longer in the workforce. They have more leisure time, more spending power, and there is this perceived rise of juvenile delinquency that is driven by these kids with, hanging out with not much to do. And also, I think these changing definitions of what constitutes juvenile delinquency, the rise of, the car culture and all of that had an impact. And into the midst of this fell Frederick Wortham, who was a psychiatrist who was born in Germany and came to the U.S. in the 1920s and eventually set up shop in New York City. And he was really interested in forensic psychiatry and did a lot of work with the court system in New York and with the psychiatric clinics at some of the major New York hospitals. And in the middle 1940s, he began studying and working with kids and teens, many of whom had been remanded to him in some way by schools or by the court system because of delinquency issues. And the thing that he began to see as he treated these kids and worked with them was that they were comics readers. And that shouldn't have been a shock for him or a surprise, because at this point in time, something like 95 or 96% of all kids and almost as many teens were reading comics just all the time, all the comics they could get their hands on. But Wortham saw this as a point of concern, and he believed that comics were a type of media, a kind of presence in the lives of young people that were causing and generating harm because of what he perceived as an emphasis on violence and sadomasochistic sexuality. And so he began to write and speak about the dangers of comics, And because of who he was and because of where he lived in New York City, he had an eager and willing market for his viewpoint. He, you know, spoke to a lot of radio programs and was interviewed in a lot of different media outlets. He was published in popular adult magazines like Ladies' Home Journal and Reader's Digest. And he purported to be studying the effects of comics on these kids he was treating. And his authority as a psychiatrist and sort of the general fears that were creeping back into the public about the bad consequences of reading comics allowed his message to be amplified in pretty phenomenal ways for this point in time. He was sort of one of the early pundits, you know, the kind of people that you would see on CNN or Fox News today.
So Wortham in the early 1950s began putting together all of his anti-comics thoughts into a book called Seduction of the Innocent, which was published in early 1954. And this happened about the same time as the Senate hearings. So Seduction came out and the Senate hearings happened a couple of weeks after the fact. There had been earlier investigations into comics that the Senate had launched around 1950, and Wortham had participated in those as well. So he was already known to them, and the arguments were known, because at this point in time, there was a growing concern among many adults and professionals, such as social workers and teachers and police officers, that comics were creating and promoting a harmful environment for kids. So the end result of Wortham's book and the Senate hearings was that comics publishers came together to create the Comics Code Authority, which was an editorial code. Some people would call it a censorship code that regulated the content of comics in a way that they hoped would stave off any kind of government intervention. And it did. The Senate, you know, sort of just said, we're not going to intervene. And the Comics Code Authority continued until 2011, although with some modifications over time.
If we fast forward about 50 years,
yes.
You are going to the Library of Congress to do some research on his papers. And what did you discover in his papers?
You know, the thing is, my earlier work on comics was really about the intersection of comics and kids in libraries, because I wanted to understand more about how libraries and librarians were dealing with this enormous influx of reading material that kids were spending a lot of their free time engaging with. So by 1940, and I know this is a little backing up a little bit, but by 1940, only a couple of years after Superman, comics were outselling kids' books by a 5-to-1 dollar margin. And kids' books were 10 times the cost of comics on average. So this is a phenomenal number of comics that were being sold. And by the early 1950s, it was something like 100 million new comics issues a month being sold in the U.S. And so I really was trying to figure out how librarians were dealing with kids sort of undermining librarians' roles as gatekeepers of children's reading and children's books. And so in 2010, the Library of Congress finally opened up this storehouse, this amazing 200 boxes of materials that had been given to them by Frederick Wortham's estate. They had had it since around 1980, and for various reasons, they had never opened it up to the public for research consultation. And as soon as it was open, I made my travel plans and I showed up at the Library of Congress because I wanted to see what was in the collection from teachers and librarians. I wanted to know what Wortham and these professionals had been talking about with regard to comics. And what I discovered after I went, you know, by the time I was just there for a few hours, was that the stuff that Wortham was reporting about kids wasn't wholly accurate. And in fact, some of it was simply made up. He kept meticulous notes, and you can see from the case studies he had of kids, from the therapeutic notes, from the correspondence and conversations he had with people, you can see how he constructed the book, Seduction of the Innocent. And I began to uncover this pattern of falsification and fabrication and just incorrect reporting about what he had seen and heard from kids. And that became ultimately to me a much more compelling story than the very small amount of correspondence he seemed to have had with teachers and librarians. And I wasn't really eager to write about these fabrications with the book. Wortham has not a great reputation anyway in contemporary society. His book, even in 1954, was viewed by many people as somewhat bombastic and just over the top in terms of its rhetorical style. There had been concerns all along about the quality of his evidence, and Wortham, by the time I was looking at his stuff in 2010, was largely viewed within the comics community as this very caricatured, you know, overbearing German professor, you know, stereotype of himself. But the more I looked at the documents and his archival materials, and the more I really thought about these kids, these very real kids whose he was purporting to treat, I got angry. And I really felt like I needed to write something to, you know, make it right for them, make it right for these kids. And so I did. I published what I thought would be a fairly unread academic paper in an academic peer-reviewed journal about some of these evidentiary problems in Seduction of the Innocent. And it turns out that more people cared about this than I could have ever imagined, even after all this time.
Yeah, because when I was going back to do research for this interview, I was like, that same story kept coming up over and over again. It's on Boing Boing, it's on New York Times, it's on it's everywhere. So.
I know, it was absolutely astounding. And I remember when the story started breaking first from my university's news service and then, you know, from Boing Boing and some other sources. I was watching Twitter, and I was watching the conversation on Twitter, and it was just like my research exploded in the Twitterverse, which was astounding. And I had people like Joe Hill and Neil Gaiman tweeting about it, and this was just unbelievable for me. As you know, I'm a pretty, you know, unremarkable in many respects. College professor, former librarian, you know, hanging out here in the Midwest. So that so many people cared about this was just, I found it incredulous almost.
Your initial research that you went there for, like you said, you were looking for the responses, the youth services librarians mm-hmm. to comics back then. Had you found any, and I know your dissertation was on that as well.
Yes.
What kind of response? You didn't find much in the Wortham papers, but what's been your what has your research shown about that? How did youth services librarians respond to comics back then? Sounds like not positively from what you said so far.
Yeah, well, I think sort of the common sense understanding of their response before I did my PhD research was that youth services librarians and K-12 teachers in the 1930s and 40s and 50s universally abhorred comics. And it is true that most of them weren't very excited about comics. Comics were viewed as, again, all of the things I mentioned earlier, that they were going to create a generation of illiterate, sex-depraved kids. But what I found, it was a little bit more subtle than that, that there were teachers and librarians who understood the draw of comics, who really sought to listen to kids, who were willing to experiment, often in fairly minor ways, but they were still willing to experiment with comics in library settings. And I think that those sort of more positive moments with regard to comics during this time period are what have become important and noteworthy to me, that there were a few libraries that were collecting comics in the 1940s, typically just the publication True Comics, which wasn't a well-loved comic among kids, but that libraries were still thinking about getting these materials into the collection early on, that there were librarians who understood that kids needed leisure reading that wasn't, you know, a Newbery-winning title, that adults had, you know, found escape in genre fiction of different kinds, and so comics could be that kind of escape reading for kids. So I really value those librarians and teachers who were able to get past their the more general opprobrium directed at comics and see that there was something worth supporting and worth valuing there.
Well, it seems like in the 21st century here, in the last decade or decade and a half or so, that the gates have really opened in libraries to comics and graphic novels, and a lot of libraries have them now. But do you still feel that there's a bias against comics in the overall library land? I mean, I know you're working with the younger generation of people when at the library and information school, so hopefully they're a little more open-minded toward it. But do you get a feeling from the whole profession of how open they are to them now?
I think things have changed for the good in a lot of wonderful ways. So I've been, when I started back in the doctoral program in the late 90s, I started, you know, teaching different LIS master's classes. So I've been teaching sort of the next generation of librarians for nearly 20 years now. And I see consistent changes in the attitudes for the students coming through our MLIS programs. I think that we're seeing now more master's students who are comics readers, even though they might not identify themselves initially as comics readers. So I think when people say the word comics, that there's this impulse to think about superhero comics and sort of the DC Marvel style stuff. And not everyone reads those. But when I ask my students about comics and I start saying, well, do you read, are there newspaper comics that you read, or are there web comics that you read? And I start throwing out titles. It's almost 100% in many instances for students who are reading comics in some form. And so I see that as a real positive change. And I see that going out, there are students who are so excited about doing comics-related programming and building comics collections in libraries. And I think there's growing support for that in the workplace. I think that you can look around the U.S. at library-based comics cons. For instance, the Kids Reads Comics annual convention at Ann Arbor Public Library there are other smaller library-focused cons at places like Chicago and Elgin, Illinois, and elsewhere. I think you can say that the tide is turning. There is still some resistance, and I see that more in school library settings than perhaps public library settings. But I think we're over the hill or over the biggest hurdle towards getting comics into the mainstream of what we do in libraries.
And do you think the objections that come to it, I mean, it's usually a lot of times it's from in schools, it's the parents and the administration, and public libraries, it's from the public, that it's just comics are just more, I don't know what the right word is, explicit. I mean, because
yeah, they're graphic, you
right? Because one of the examples pictures that I use is that, you know, you can read a mystery book or whatever that might describe a sex scene, but that's different than reading a comic that's showing you a sex scene, and it doesn't seem like intellectually that it should be different, but then somebody when they see bare naked bodies, it's different for them.
No, it is. I mean, the visual element is part of what makes comics so fantastic and what makes them so scary for some people. And I think that it is the fear that there is going to be something, you know, quote unquote, inappropriate in comics for readers. And I think that, you know, I don't have an intellectual, philosophical problem with parents or community members challenging library materials. I mean, I think that's part of what it means to live in a democratic society. I think that's part of what we have to expect and encourage in library culture, that people ask questions about what we're doing. But I think that often when comics are challenged, it comes from a misunderstanding or about the role of libraries' collections or about how the comics medium works. I think that we do still have some room to be better about educating the public, about educating our colleagues about comics, about how to make good collection development choices, about how we shelve comics and promote them to the readers that we work with, the readers of all ages. You know, it's not just kids who are reading comics. It's people of all ages. And there are some comics that, you know, I don't think would be well served shelved in a teen collection or in a kid's collection that would be awesome in an adult collection in a public library setting.
Right. I want to get back to a couple of that in a minute, but do you have a sense of when the tide really turned? Because it seems like it was for the mainstream culture of acceptance of comics, it sort of started with some DC stuff in the 80s of the mm-hmm. Watchmen, Dark Knight Returns, and then Mouse winning the whatever it won, the Pulitzer.
The special Pulitzer.
The special Pulitzer, yes. And then so it sort of seemed like a snowball there, but it seemed like what really exploded it, and especially into libraries, was the influx of manga, which came through bookstores before it came to the libraries. But that seemed to be what really pushed, finally, libraries into having big, huge graphic novel collections. Do you have any sense of anything different from that, or do you?
No, I think that's accurate. For me, I mean, I began to see some, you know, glimmers of hope around 2000, and then say around 2005 was the next big surge, and then certainly since 2010, I mean, I think that's we can say that comics have mostly arrived in libraries starting in 2010. But I think between 2000 and 2005 was the first big broad wave of acceptance.
Yeah, it seems like now it makes it easier on libraries now, too, that the mainstream big six publishers, big five publishers now, I guess, are publishing comics now, because that kind of fits into our already workflows of working with them and working with their distributors. And because I know early on it was kind of hard working with, and it still is a little bit, I think, with DC mm-hmm. and Marvel and things, because they don't think in terms of things being collected. And so it's like,
right,
I always look at our graphic novel collection and there's five different things that say Green Lantern number one, and it's like, well, but which one is it? Because it's like volume 3, volume 8, and so it's confusing to all the way we want to do things, and they're not necessarily made in a durable format, and they're not
right
easily reorderable because they kind of do a one big print run and then they're done.
Yeah, no, I mean, floppy comics and the mainstream comics, the stuff from DC and Marvel in particular, are still really challenging. But I think we can take heart that, you know, we do have companies like Macmillan and Penguin and Scholastic who are publishing comics sometimes through particular imprints. It's not like in, you know, 1995, where if you wanted comics in your library's collection, you had to make friends with your local comic book shop. There's still some value in doing that. I strongly, you know, urge my students to make friends with the folks at the local comic shop, to figure out what people are reading in the community, and to get their hands on stuff that might not be available through Baker and Taylor. But yeah, there is, it is easier. We have review journals now that talk about comics. We've got ALA sponsored awards that awards and lists that include comics on them. So I think we're definitely moving forward in a good way.
And at the University of Illinois, you teach several classes about comics as well. One of them I wanted to get your opinion on. One of them is a reader's advisory in comics.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about how you approach reader's advisory with comics differently than just regular reader's advisory, like a regular reader's advisory class would cover it?
Sure. So I've been teaching an eight weeks comics reader's advisory course that somehow is always really hard to say for the past,
a lot of weird apostrophes in there, I think, too. So.
Yes, that as well. For the last 4 years, I think. And my approach to it is to emphasize both the wide array of age audience age and in comics publishing, so that we look at comics for kids and teens and adults, that we look across different styles and formats of comics, so that it includes web comics, it includes newspaper comics and magazine focused editorial cartooning, and that we look at also different genres, so that we're talking about nonfiction and superhero and adventure comics and a whole host of other stuff. But I think the thing that really distinguishes doing comics readers advisory from traditional readers advisory is the visual, and that it's not enough to focus solely on the text story and the words and the dialogue when you're doing comics readers advisory. You really have to get an understanding of the visual and artistic style, how the page reads, how it scans from that visual perspective, because we are, as readers, attracted to and repulsed by the visual as much as we might be the pace of the storytelling, the textual storytelling, or you know, the characterization or other things. And all of that has to work together. And I think that for many library students, even though in youth services we talk about picture books, for instance, and we talk about, you know, the Caldecott Award and how picture books work, and about using, you know, asking questions around pictures with emergent readers, we're still not very comfortable with stopping and thinking about pictures and about images and about that whole visual element that is so integral to comics. And so one of the things that we really focus on in the class is slowing down and being very intentional about looking at the page, about looking at the panels, about thinking about how to describe the visual style in terms of the same kind of appeal factors we might use for more conventional text-based stories.
And you've got a couple of other projects going on through the campus, and sure. I wanted to talk about a couple of them. One of them is you got an award recently to do a project called Children, Comics, and Print Culture. Can you talk a little bit about what the purpose of that program is and what you want to get done with that?
Yeah, so this is a longer-term project, although I've got some funding coming up for the next year, that is going to allow me, I hope, to do a social history of what it meant and what it means to be a young comics reader in the U.S. So if you think about the fact that comics was arguably the most important print culture medium of the 20th century, that virtually every kid who was alive in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s was a comics reader, that is a phenomenal activity that we don't really know much about. We don't really know much about the experiences of those readers and what they got out of comics and how comics fit in their lives. And so I've been working the last couple of years to start recovering some of those stories and you know, how kids played with comics and the fan culture that they produced around comics during this time period. And so this project is really going to allow me to push forward with that and tell the story, I hope, in a way that is compelling and readable and does that generation of comics readers justice in speaking to and about their experiences.
Okay, and the other project I wanted to ask you about was one that you're doing with a couple of other professors called the Comic Book Readership Archive. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so it's related in some ways to the children comics and print culture, except that what we're trying to do with COBRA, or the Comic Book Readership Archive, is create a digital scholarly portal that will amass what we know about comics readership. And this will be fan letters, the names of people who entered contests, the people who contributed to fanzines, any kind of fan-related activity that we can identify through print. We're trying to amass it in this portal, and we're starting with the Marvel comics between 1961 and 1973, although our goal is to really look broadly throughout the 20th century and across comics publishers. And this will allow people like me and other comic scholars to begin to identify trends in readership. So, who was writing and responding and reading horror comics, or, were there geographical trends over time in readership or age trends? One of the things I've discovered going back to the 1930s and 40s, for instance, is that a lot of the comics that were coming out during this time period provided informal ways for kids to write to one another and to, create an intentional kind of fan culture. So you can go back and see lists of kids in Fawcett Comics publications, for instance, who wanted pen pals in 1942 and what their addresses were and how old they were, or kids who were writing letters to talk about their favorite characters in a particular comic, or who were entering in a contest to win $5. And I think that this is really important because we don't have good records for comics readership. And so this is one way of getting at some of that stuff. You know, who was reading comics? What were they reading? How were they participating and engaging with comics over time?
And it seemed like in that period, Marvel did seem to be big on that. So I guess that's part of why you chose that section there. I mean, did you get access to some of that Mary Marvel Marching Society stuff?
Oh, yeah. So John Walsh, who's at Indiana University in the Department of Library and Information Science there, he is a huge Marvel fan. And so this was part his idea for a place to start, because he had access to a lot of the materials and because he was familiar with the publications during this time. But he and Catherine Labar, my other collaborator, we have spent several days already at Michigan State University using the comics collection there to photograph some of the fan pages and the letters pages and go through stuff like the issues of the Mary Marvel Marching Society and Marvel Mania and a whole host of other fanzines that were published during this era. So I think that we are not aren't through documenting even all of the Marvel related publications for that 12-year period. And we're already looking at something like 11 or 12,000 records just to start.
Wow.
So,
that's
yeah, I know. It's a little bit daunting. I mean, I think we realized that there were going to be a large number of records to deal with, but not quite that many. So we may be spending the next 20 years of our academic careers doing this.
You're going to read a lot of Stan Lee, I think.
I know, no kidding.
A lot of Excelsiors.
Yes. You know, but they're fun to read. And,
yeah.
And I, yeah. So it's a great way to be able to do scholarship, you know, to have something that you find compelling, that you enjoy, that it's a pleasure to get up in the morning and work with. I mean, I find that with comics broadly. It's a pleasure and a privilege to get to teach about this stuff, to research this stuff, to talk to people like you and circulating ideas, listeners about comics. It really is very cool to be able to do that.
Okay, well, I'm gonna wrap up, and I'm gonna ask you the question that you dreaded me asking you when we were talking before. What's your favorite comic, or if you can just give a couple of examples of what your favorites are?
Well, as I told you before we started recording, I have a really hard time answering this question, but I'll tell you what I'm reading right now that I think is kind of fun, and I just wrapped up the first 6 issues of Gotham Academy. I don't often read sort of the DC and Marvel stuff, but Gotham Academy, Becky Cloonan and Carl Kershaw and Brendan Fletcher are doing that series. And I think it's just a lot of fun, sort of Harry Potter-esque in a way. And I'm looking forward. I just got a copy of Dylan Horrock's new book called Sam Zabel in the Magic Pen. And as soon as I get my grading done, that's what I'm settling in to read.
I took my son to Free Comic Book Day this year, and we picked up a Tiny Titans thing for him. And he's 4 years old. And then my daughter is 8 years old, and we got her Zeta the Space Girl. I don't know if you've...
Yeah, I love Zeta. Ben Hackey does great stuff.
Yeah, so that's really their first comic, so we'll see how that goes.
Fantastic.
Because I have a bunch from when I was a kid, but they're not for 4-year-olds and 8-year-olds, I don't feel like. It's superhero stuff from the 80s and 90s, and it's like a little advanced. I don't want to see them watch them punching people too much. So.
I understand.
All right, well, Carol, can you tell people how they can find out more about you online, where they can contact you?
Sure. So the easiest thing, you can email me at ctilley at illinois.edu. You can visit my website, which is www.caroltilley.net, or you can find me on Twitter at an uncivil PhD or at Comics Crusader.
All right. Thanks a lot, Carol.
Thank you so much for asking me, Steve. And this has been fun.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the show or listen to past episodes, you can visit circulatingideas.com or follow us on Twitter at CircIdeas. We're also on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com, or you can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can drop us a line at mail@circulatingideas.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating the ideas. Well, see, now I didn't ask you why you're an uncivil PhD, but
that's a really long story.
Well, I'll have you back sometime. You can explain that story.
All right.